Today I'm talking with Stephen Lewis, and Stephen is the president of the Forum for Theological Exploration, and he, with two of his colleagues, Matthew Williams and Dory Baker, have co-authored a book called The Care Effect, Enact Your Most Faithful Next Step, which will be published by Chalice, hopefully, in November of 2019. I know that the FTE is a very innovative organization, and they've thought a lot about this whole idea of creativity and innovation and trying and doing new things. So
let's start with, how would you define innovation, and are there particular barriers standing in the way of churches working in an innovative way or embracing innovation?
And I don't think it's just particular to church. I think it's particular to human nature, which is, you know, we typically are reluctant to any change that happens to us. And we like to be engaged in change when we're ready to be engaged in it. And the vast majority of us don't like change. So when people see innovation, I think they also hear that as proxy for change. And proxy for change can also sometimes mean, you know, it is a veto or is a judgment on them and what has worked for them versus it being something about how can we make it even better, or how can we make it more inclusive, or how can we value what has been done and at the same time value the ways in which we might need to adapt, to respond, to be nimble for what is to come. And I think that's some of what you see in what Greg Jones is trying to hold up with kind of tradition innovation, though I would say, you know, from my point of view, I think of it more of kind of like it is this type of African kind of saying and idea, which is Sankofa. How do we look back and bring the best of our past forward into the future so it can be beneficial to the present? I think Greg is trying to say something similar when he's talking about tradition innovation, which is innovation is being drawn upon, you know, the traditions of our past. And I would say sometimes it breaks tradition. That's why I think tradition innovation, it can fall apart if you're really trying to be innovative. I think in the end, sometimes innovation is about breaking from the past.
It's the wisdom or the discernment it takes to know when is it time to bring something forward from the past or to retrieve and to remake that, and when is it time to just say, it's over. We can't continue in that way anymore.
Yeah, in many ways, you know, innovation is discernment. I mean, it is a process of discernment. We don't come through a discernment process and do nothing, at least hopefully. Hopefully discernment leads towards us doing something radically different or evolutionarily different than what we currently are in our current state of things. And that's, in many ways, that's what call is, right? I mean, call is a calling to do something maybe different than what you are. It's not necessarily a departure. Sometimes it's building upon, you know, something of the past, but sometimes it is a departure. But there's a whole process about how do you do that. And I think innovation is a kind of discernment process towards that end. So innovation could be used as a way of, as the congregation thinks about discernment on a number of different issues as it relates to their work. New ministries, how do we sunset existing ministries? How do we think about calling forth the next generation of leaders, to thinking about whether or not we should build into a new kind of capital campaign, or should we keep our church small and find other ways in which we can leverage those resources than just build a building? Or how do we move from being just simply a come and see organization to a go and make kind of disciple organization in the broader community? You could use an innovative process to do all those kinds of things. So I don't think there's any one particular thing that it can be useful for or not. I think the broader question is, what is innovation? And how do people understand innovation?
Do you use that language with congregations, or do you just use the word discernment?
I think it depends on the audience. And you try to use kind of the lingua franca of the group or whatever. So, I mean, I think it really is about how people respond. And sometimes we need to break out of the categories that we're accustomed to in order to see from a different perspective or something new. Younger people tend to be open to it, but, you know, it's such a used phrase. It's such a... increasingly, like in the broader kind of sphere beyond religious institution, I mean, it is a buzzword. And in our field, it is becoming even more of a catch-all kind of buzzword phrase. So I think part of what I'm wrestling with is this idea that innovation, I'm kind of drawing on kind of two different camps. So there's one out of Harvard that comes out of the kind of Christian Claytonson group. And then there's another one that kind of comes out of it's a Kellogg professor who's kind of, you know, thinking about innovation or whatever. But one of the things I would say is that innovation can be thought of as a noun, and innovation could also be thought of as a verb or some type of activity. As a noun, what I would say is that, you know, innovation, broadly speaking, is simply something different that has impact. And I think innovation as a verb is a process of creating value by applying a novel solution to a meaningful problem. So it is a process that leverages novel solutions to find a solution to a problem. Or as a noun, it's just something different that has impact. Now, one of the things that I would say also too is that for me, and the way that we've been talking in our shop, is that there is a typology when it comes to innovation. In other words, I want to suggest that there are at least four different types of ways for talking about innovation beyond simply as a noun or a verb. So there's innovation that non-religious people do. There is innovation that Christian leaders do. Then there is non-religious people who are engaged in what I would call Christian innovation. And there are Christians who are working at trying to do Christian innovation. The vast majority of at least the conversations I've been in are about Christians doing innovation. And that is not the same as Christian innovation. And I think the distinction for me is that Christian innovation is ultimately something different that has gospel impact. In other words, Christian innovation has a particular telos. It has a particular end. And the end, and I think, is about the gospel. Now, of course, there are many different ways to interpret that, what the good news is, but I think that is the telos to Christian innovation as a noun. As a verb, I think Christian innovation similarly is a process for creating value by applying novel solutions to meaningful problems that result in gospel impact. So what then is gospel impact? From where I sit, I would say that gospel impact is what Jesus speaks about in Luke 4:18-19, when he talks about the Spirit of the Lord is upon him. That people in communities who become his disciples or fall in his way are called to engage in the same spirit who seeks to be upon them for the sake of God's goodness, which is about human flourishing. That's John 10:10, you know, the whole idea about abundant life for all people. It's also about the well-being of all community. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Or it's about the healing of all nations in the world, which is Revelation 22. So the way in which I think about the gospel impact, I think I'm trying to tie that back to this young adult, person of color, a lower socioeconomic status, born to a teenage mother who's an immigrant, who is the founder of our faith, who always finds himself at odds with the religious authorities and moving in between religious communities and the broader community, trying to be an embodiment of the God who has emptied God's self into him. And what he says, I use that 4:18 and then, you know, use those other iterations of it. So Christian innovation as a verb, I think, is all ultimately in service to the ends of the gospel impact. So we can talk about Christians doing innovation. I'm not sure Christians doing innovation is distinctively different from non-Christians doing innovation. But I think Christians who engage in Christian innovations is working towards a particular telos. Because there are a lot of Christians who are doing innovative things to make money. And that is the telos, which is to, you know, to make a living, to support a lifestyle. And that's not any different from a non-religious person or somebody of a different faith.
Then your argument about Christian innovation is that the end, the larger ultimate purpose and motivation, really is a shaping force. and the discernment, just to go back to your piece about if it's really a verb and I really have to discern what's to be done here, your ultimate vision, whatever religious language you put around that, the ultimate gospel impact that you define really shapes that discernment.
Right. I mean, I think it's about a new heaven and a new earth, or it's a transformed world. Christian innovation should be in service to that. In my mind, part of the question is like, what is the purpose of Christian innovation? And I think how it's distinctive from other things is that there's this idea of purpose, serendipity, calling. There's this kind of numinous awe that I think faith becomes a catalyzing effect for innovation. But ultimately, it's in service to a transformed world, which is about an alternative to the status quo or empire, as we see in first century Christianity. It is in service to the well-being of all. It's about human flourishing, but it's also about, you know, God's preferential kind of treatment and beginning point, which is the least among us. So anyway, you know, I would say that this right here, you know, in my mind is the purpose of Christian innovation. The starting place is not our center or about our starting point, but it's where God has already been operating and we're trying to catch up to. It is about a better world. I think there is some inventiveness in what's happening, and it's an iterative history. It is not ahistorical. I think there are imposters to innovation or Christian innovation. Like, change is an imposter. Just because you do something different doesn't mean that it's necessarily innovative. Just because something is cool does not mean that it is Christian innovation. Just because something is good does not mean it's Christian innovation. Now, Christian innovation, I think, does bring about change. I think it can be creative. I think it can be cool and it can be good, but those things are not proxy for Christian innovation. And I think in our context, in the religious context, you can leverage Christian innovation because I think ultimately at the end, it is about communities and so it's necessarily social. But it is about services. It could be about a process or process improvement. It could be Christian innovation could be about an experience. How do you create a different kind of experience? Or it can be about our ritual life, whether that's worship or some other ritual that we use in service to the kind of different markers within, you know, the different stages of life. And then, you know, I'll just say that finally that part of what we've been working on is an approach to Christian innovation, which is moving people from this idea that in the end is about inventing alternatives to the powers that be so that we can create a transformed world of a new heaven and new earth. But it's all grounded in our values and our motivation, which calls us to get curious about our context and the people that we want to work with and the holy other in which God operates in. It's about making meaning of our experiences as a result of our curiosity. Is being open to imagine and ideating new ideas, then it's about experimenting, try something, do something. Like Pentecost came and folks are like, okay, we got to do something new. We no longer have to go to the Jerusalem temple. And then you see Peter and the disciples in Acts 1 through 10 experimenting, trying something. And then you see this idea of like validating and proving, like, I don't know if I can go to the Gentiles because it's unclean. And then you see like, stuff happening as, you know, God comes to them in dreams and you see other ways in which it's proven and then you go and do it. In that assumes then, you know, that there are different mindsets, different kind of methods about how you go about doing that.
Wow, this is really fascinating. So I see just how creative, you know, putting this model together, it has some of the IDEO language and process in it, but that you've also just really said God's at work in this process.
Yes.
For it to be Christian innovation. And in another slide you had, you know, that the FTE, you had some theological principles there. You know, it has to speak to the least among us. Christian innovation is, it focuses on the least among us, about creating new solutions to problems, experimentation in the margins,
yeah.
New and alternative to what is or has been enhanced by diversity and collaboration, ancient, ancestral, iterative, and evolving.
Yes.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're still kind of working through this, but, I mean, there is, like, some method to our madness. Like, we have a whole framework that I'm trying to work through which is this idea that, you know, it centers the margins. Jesus says, suffer not the little children, but bring them to me. Like, these children were in the margins of the community. He says, bring them closer to me. It is about a type of liberatory authorship. Mm-hmm. That we can be co-authors in our own liberation. It is autobiographical in the sense that the margins are resources. Blessed are the poor. There is an ancestral legacy and a gift in this type of autobiographical worldview. Then you have the kind of democratized praxis. Some of this is, you know, Paulo Freire and others, but it's about the disinherited, as Thurman talks about Jesus and the disinherited. The disinherited can innovate. They've been innovating. When you think about disinherited communities who've always been working in the shadows of our empire, modern and ancient, that praxis focus on the structures to be transformed or alternatives, and that working and acting with versus working for others or on behalf of others, which is really a pushback against the missionary stance that has happened in so many places around the world where white missionaries have come trying to do good or whatever, but really have been colonizing or making other folks into their own image. And then this idea that teaching and learning innovation is a political act. What Jesus was talking about was this idea that disciples of the way are participating in God's work of shaping the well-being of community. And then his ancestral way of knowing, the stories that we tell ourselves. Our gospel stories are not just static stories, but they're stories that we tell ourselves over and over again. They're intuitive practices. There's an interplay between the mind and the emotion and the spirit and the senses between the body and the natural world. And then this whole idea is that prayer and fasting, all these things are representative of a kind of a sacred technology that helps ground ourselves, that helps slow us down. It helps us become more present to spirit and God who works in the everyday and mundane of life. And then this idea that we are engaged in the production as primary activity of humanity, that we are called to you know, into this work of production, and we're creators of good and so on and so on. So these are just some of the when we think about a Christian framework, a transformed world requires a kind of autobiographical worldview, a democratized praxis, ancestral ways of knowing, and this idea that we can be creators of alternatives. We in our organization have been saying time and time, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be an alternative to the ways in which we work. There has to be an alternative to the ways in which we do our work. And there has to be a better way that allows us to be whole people and not work like machines, and to allow us the type of space and time to reflect and to lead profound change that a calling calls within ourselves, within our organizations and our communities, and then catalyzes us to participate in what God is calling us to do in the world. And to do that, what we realize is that change is not merely a game of trade-offs, in which we sacrifice personal and communal well-beings for the pursuit of shared ideas, is believing that a better world is possible. You know, and we don't have to resign ourselves, you know, the kind of reproducing social realities that we say we don't want. So this another way is really kind of articulating a process that we call a care approach. And it's about how one creates space in a community, ask self-awakening questions within a community, reflect together critically and theologically, and then enact our next most faithful steps towards the ways in which we're being called to live and to lead the kind of change that we want to bring about in service to a transformed world and a new heaven and a new earth. This book is for people who ask the question, so how do I lead in pursuit of what I'm for, rather than getting stuck in what I'm against? How can I learn to lead a life? How can I learn to lead in life-giving ways? When I get greater clarity about myself and my call, how do I take steps to move in that direction? How do I mobilize my organization to be present in the world differently? And how do I adapt faithfully to the complex shifts in our environments? And how do I keep on leading change without burning out?
You know that our initiative called The Lives of Meaning and Purpose is to help people in congregations engage the meaning of vocation in their lives.
Yes.
So what do you think, you've already said this a little bit, but what do you think is the connection between vocation and innovation?
Vocation and innovation. Well, I would say this is that, you know, in the end, vocation is the long arc of the life of an organization or people or an individual. And it moves towards the telos, which is one's purpose in life. And in the rearview mirror, in hindsight, what we can see are the episodic moments in our lives which are callings. Callings are the breadcrumbs that leads us on this type of vocational arc towards our purpose. And we talk a little bit about that in the book. But I think, you know, you can't get to leadership without dealing with issues of identity and context and communities and how you were shaped as an individual, your politics and the other kind of market as well as social forces and familial forces that have shaped you as an individual around your identity and your gifts and your deep longings and your questions. You can't become a leader without dealing with these questions around vocation. And if a leader is going to lead, a leader has to lead in the midst of uncertainty. Otherwise, you don't need a leader. You just need a manager, because a manager already knows where it's going. They just needs to manage from point A to point B. But a leader has to be able to lead in midst of uncertainty, in the mystery of life, in awe. And it takes a community of people who are engaged in leadership. And oftentimes, leadership and leading requires profound change within ourselves. Innovation is a novel process, a novel discernment process that allows people to bring about change by coming up with novel solutions that ordinary people can do extraordinary things to meet the problems that they face